Welcome to Beyond Blathers, the podcast where we dive deeper into the insects, fish, and fossils you can find in Animal Crossing New Horizons. I'm Sophia Osborne.
And I'm Olivia DeBercier.
And today we are so excited to have an amazing special guest on our show, evolutionary biologist and entomologist Dr. Jessica Ware, host of the really great science communication show Insectarium on PBS.
Yeah, so welcome, Dr. Ware, to the show. We're so happy to be speaking with you today about ladybugs and then also about your career and experience as a biologist and a science communicator.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, could you please introduce yourself?
My name is Dr. Jessica Ware, and I am a curator of invertebrate zoology here at the American Museum of Natural History. And I'm also the division chair. I'm originally from Canada also, so I am a Canadian and I'm living here in the United States.
Great. Yeah, we were just chatting before the show about Dr. Ware's undergrad is from UBC, which is where I got my master's from. And yeah, it's really exciting to have such a prominent Canadian entomologist on the show. Yeah, so we're going to start by talking a bit about ladybugs. And as we do every week, we like to first start off with what Blathers from Animal Crossing has to say about the insect fish or fossil we're doing on the show. So yeah, if you bring a ladybug to Blathers, he'll say, "Yes, yes. Ladybugs are quite beloved thanks to their tiny round shape and adorable spots. To that, I say bah. The fact of the matter is some have stripes instead of spots, and some have no marking at all. No, I shall never understand why it's said when a ladybug lands on you, you'll have good luck. I shall only have a fainting spell."
Nice.
Yeah, Blathers is known for being a little bit afraid of bugs. And so often we have to dispel a little bit of the fear that is promoted by the quote.
Well, he was dropping some knowledge there. The fact that they weren't all polka dotted, that some are striped and even without any patterns. So kudos to him for those facts.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about, like, what is a ladybug taxonomically and how many species are out there?
Well, so ladybugs are not bugs, they're beetles. So, you know, you could call them ladybird beetles if you'd rather. A lot of people in other parts of the world outside of North America call them ladybirds. And ladybird beetles are just a single family, Coccinellidae. So they're in the order Coleoptera, which are the beetles. They're the family Coccinellidae. And there's around 6,000 species or so of coccinellids. And they really do vary. So Blathers, kudos. Like, they really do vary. And most of them are kind of round, as he described, but some of them are more oval or even a little bit elongate. A lot of them have polka dots. Some of them don't. Some of them have stripes. Some of them have plain colors. A lot of them are red. Not all of them are red. So there's variety, heterogeneity.
I just realized, I guess our listeners won't be able to see, but you're wearing ladybug colors.
Oh.
And your nails.
Actually, that wasn't intentional, but maybe that's coincidence. I have a red cardigan on, dear listeners.
It's very, I love that, the themed costuming. So for ladybugs, okay, so we've got a really big diversity of beetles here, and people tend to really like them. Can you explain why that is?
Yeah, it's hard to know. I mean, some people have a positive reaction to them because people have told them that they're good luck. So there is this kind of, as Blathers alluded to, right, that maybe you'll have good luck if they land on you. People like who grow crops have been for over 100 years have been using them as kind of natural pest control. So while we tended to see in the early 20th century literature, people talking about insects as being like injurious, or like they used these adjectives that were really negative to describe insects, they often described these as kind of green, you know, positive insects, like very positive adjectives, because they eat aphids, because they eat other things that might be, you know, white flies and things like that might be eating crops. So maybe that translated to a general idea that they're positively, you know, associated with humans. They don't hurt us or harm us. They're also very pretty. I think we tend to like things that are very pretty. And there's kind of a beauty to these insects, sometimes the polka dots, sometimes the stripes, but regardless, they're really brightly colored usually because they have aposematic warning coloration. The colors are actually a signal that they're not palatable. They're not good to eat, but we tend to love those colors. We love monarchs for maybe the same reason. Like, we tend to like things that are really kind of bright and flashy. So maybe that's also part of the reason why people like them. Their mouth parts are really well hidden. Also, people don't like looking at things with giant mouth parts coming towards them, maybe. And these have their mouth parts kind of tucked away.
Yeah, that's so true. It's funny because people, like, it's funny, think of something like cockroaches, which tend to have their heads a little bit tucked under, but people have such a negative association with them. But something like ladybugs, they still have this almost like turtle-like tucked in head that makes them seem so cute. And I find like when I encounter kids who are scared of roaches, I'm like, but look, its head is all like tucked in and kind of cute. And it's got little antenna sticking out.
Yeah. I mean, it is, I think ladybugs, unlike roaches, you know, we tend not to think of them as being associated with disease and filth, even though like very small percentage of roaches actually do that, go in and out of the sewer. But the ones that do give a really bad name. I bet you if there was like, you know, ladybird beetles that were transmitting Giardia or something, then we would suddenly see people being really, you know, unenthused about them coming around. But now we just think of them as summertime. When we're outside enjoying nature, they're out there.
Yeah, and like the garden. You said that they have aposematic coloration. So if you were to taste one, do you know if it would taste really bad to us? Or is that just something that a typical beetle predator would notice?
I think it would taste bitter to us. And you can actually, like, if you disturb some ladybird beetles, they actually will like spit out this kind of dark colored liquid. And I have tasted that and it did taste very bitter. I've tasted it intentionally and unintentionally because it gets on your hands and it is very bitter. But really, we're not the main, I don't think this has evolved for us as the main reason, right? I think it's for some of the other predators that they would be encountering in nature. So whenever you see things that are kind of converging on these red, often red and black or orange and black, sometimes yellow and black patterns, that's the word we use. We use aposematic warning coloration is another way to call it. But I mean, colors can do a lot of different things. So aposematism is one, but for all we know, the colors also, you know, affect their maybe thermoregulation, or maybe there's other types of signals that they can use to communicate with each other. We just know for sure that they are distasteful.
And could you talk a bit more about the markings that Blathers mentioned? I guess one, I don't know, rumor that I've heard is that the number of spots correlates with their age. Is that true at all?
I don't think so. I think that there's like species specific variation. Sometimes you can see some variation in the total number of spots in a given species or among populations. But in general, they're kind of like patterns that are associated with, you know, this particular species, that particular species, or a particular genus of ladybugs or ladybird beetles. Because their juvenile stage looks very different from the adult stage. I should just mention that Coleoptera are holometabolous insects. So that means they go through complete metamorphosis. So they go from an egg to a larva to a pupa and then to the adult stage. So the ladybird beetles that you see that are like, you might imagine one that's red with black polka dots, that's the adult stage. And it actually isn't going to change no matter how long the adult lives, right? That's it's kind of fixed once it becomes the adult. The juvenile stage is where there's kind of a lot of growth happening, where they molt from one instar to the next. And those don't have spots generally. They tend to be also kind of red and black or orange and black. They kind of have that same warning coloration, but they look kind of long and thin and kind of rugose or jagged, you know, rough looking. And they definitely don't look like the adult.
Yeah, I've always found they look like tiny little dragons. Like they've got that scale-like quality. And it's sort of this very frequently like a gray black matte color that they have. It's really cool. It reminds me of this like really weird lizard called a Malleura mastix. It's like this really chunky desert lizard that also has these little like scaly things on it. But I always love in the summer, people send me photos and they're like, what is this? You're like, I've never seen this before. I'm like, well, it's very common. It's just the baby ladybug, the little mini version of it.
Wow. Yeah. Our listeners should definitely look up a picture. They look so different. It's so strange that they go from like being these very metal looking, like intense looking, you know, larvae, and then into really very adorable adults. Wow. It's just a phase.
And are those larvae also predaceous? Like, the adults, they're out there eating crop pests like aphids and stuff. Are the larvae doing the same thing?
Yeah. So, I mean, most of the coccinellids are eating other animals. Some of them don't, but majority of them are eating other animals, both in the juvenile stage and in the adult stage.
And I recall when I was watching your video, you were talking about the sort of like blood defense or the hemolymph, as we call it
bleeding.
In insects. Yeah. Can you explain that?
Well, I mean, so they are kind of this stuff that they're secreting out is kind of foul tasting, because they sequester some volatile, some compounds, some secondary defense compounds. So they're able to kind of leak it out as part of their whole don't mess with me vibe, right? So they're able to do it without, I mean, it's not like it doesn't injure them, although it does use up resources. So it's energetically expensive to do so. But if it saves them from being consumed, you would expect it to be selected for by natural selection. Then they can live to pass their genes on and do that behavior in the next generation.
Yeah, that's such a weird one. Like, I remember when I learned that, I was like, that's what they're doing when you hold them. And you were saying before that they like kind of eject this weird little yellow or brown dot on you. It's so cool. It's my favorite fact to share with students. I'm like, look at that.
My Nana used to call it tar.
Tar.
Yeah, she was always like, they're going to put tar on your hands. She would say, because grasshoppers also kind of spit out something, and she would, whenever you got something on it, she would always call it insect tar. Have you ever heard that? Maybe she just made it up.
I really like that, though. I'm going to use that in the future.
Yep.
I have a question that I think I know kind of the answer, but I'd love to hear what your take is on this. Why is it that you so often find ladybugs, especially like dead ladybugs, in between window panels? Have you ever seen this phenomenon?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, they're... So as I mentioned, like a lot of people have been using ladybird beetles as kind of natural pest management for like over 100 years. And in large part, especially in the last 50 years or so, people maybe a little bit less, but around that amount of time, people have been importing ladybird beetles. So they aren't necessarily native ladybird beetles that people are using for pest management for their gardens and what have you. So what that means is we actually have a lot of invasive species, and one in particular, Harmonia, it actually tends to aggregate in people's houses in the winter rather than kind of hanging out under the leaf litter and the debris outside. And so often when the insects come into your house, they often are like enjoying the sunshine of the window. There's often moisture that's around the window, and some of them don't live the entire winter season. And so then their fate is to die. If your house is very dry, they also can dry out. But often they kind of will aggregate on like a wall that has a lot of sunshine or along, you know, a window pane. And then if they do kick the bucket, then that's where they end up, because that's where they were hanging out.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Yeah, I've seen that and I go, what is happening here? Why is it seems to always be the ladybugs too?
Yeah, yeah.
See this unfortunate fate. So there we go.
We get them also in where I live is in New Jersey, and we have Halium orphalis, which is a brown marmorated stink bug. It's an invasive species that comes inside people's houses, and we often get them. They aggregate, but then they often end up like near the window too. So we've got a bunch of them laying on their backs on the windowsill in my house, as well as ladybird beetles.
Yeah, I suppose those would be a little less desirable for a couple reasons than the ladybugs.
Do you have any other favorite facts about ladybird beetles?
Well, I like that ladybird beetles are kind of part of human culture in a way that, I mean, some insects have crossed over, right? There's like a lot of butterflies that are part of human culture, and people write stories about them. Dragonflies feature in human lore, I think, a lot. But so do I mean, there's like a nursery rhyme song even, ladybird, ladybug, fly away home, your house is on fire, your children are gone, right? Like, that's right there. It's in part of the thing that we teach children, every human child. It seems like here's some version of a song about a nursery rhyme at this point. And also, I think there's like some paintings from the Renaissance period and even a little bit earlier that pictured religious figures kind of wearing bright red. And so some of the names for ladybird beetles actually relate to these artistic works and the religious figures. So I kind of think that's fascinating that insects, this particular little tiny beetle, is actually woven in the fabric of human history and human culture.
Yeah, I get excited every time I see little beetles and artwork and things. It just feels nice as a biologist. It feels like affirming. You're like, oh, someone else cared about this hundreds of years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah, it feels like insects don't get the same representation for sure.
I mean, hopefully people will hear this and love ladybird beetles enough that they'll take care of their gardens and leave aphids around sometimes for them to eat and not spray everything.
Yeah, I suppose that's a good thing to always remind listeners of is like, leave the garden, let things grow, try not to cut everything down if you can. The bugs love it. And then they go and they take care of the pests for you if you're lucky.
Great. Well, yeah, we'd love to talk to you more about you and your work as well. Could you start by telling us about your PBS show, Insectarium?
Sure. So the Insectarium is a show that has multiple episodes, and each episode features a different insect and somebody that is studying that insect. And so we've featured a lot of different insects over the course of the show so far, and we have a few more coming up. We've tried to like highlight different people working in, you know, industry, in academia, volunteers, community scientists, people working in museums, people working in the tropics, like really a variety of ways that you can study and be around insects. Anyone can work with insects. You don't need to necessarily have a degree that says you're an entomologist. So we've featured ladybird beetles and the science behind this kind of chemical of fear that they emit, this perfume of fear. We studied dragonflies, fireflies. Fireflies are very cool. I'm a big fan. I knew a little bit about fireflies, but I certainly learned a lot. Each time we've done one of these episodes, we get to work with experts who are working on that topic. And it's always great to kind of learn more about an animal. So the Insectarium is available on PBS Terra. So you can watch it with PBS Digital Studios. And then we also do like a companion social media video that comes out the week after an Insectarium episode. And it sometimes features that same insect, or it features somebody who we interviewed from that particular episode, which has been pretty fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the videos. It very much felt like something I haven't seen really before in insect SciComm videos, which is it feels like a really cool and like accurate representation of what it is like to be in this field. There's just so many people working on some really interesting projects. Some of them are a bit more like integrated into, like you said, industry, like the pest space and how we can manage pests. But yeah, it's really nice to watch. I really like that it's got a bit of a focus on like the researchers themselves and the work they're doing, in addition to like how amazing the actual insects are. So, and you can find that on YouTube, right? That's where I was finding it. I don't know if there's other places you said on PBS itself.
Yeah, well, PBS Digital Studios has like a YouTube channel that you can get the videos right there. And yeah, I think it's been so interesting to kind of see behind the scenes. I feel like every Insectarium episode in a way is like going behind the scenes for a particular topic. And that's part of the producer and creator, Aaron Chapman's vision, I think, is to, you know, kind of peel back the curtain a little bit so people could see like, oh, we know this thing about cockroaches or about termites, but how do we know that? Who's actually studying that? How did we discover this? Or we know this thing about monarchs, but like, who's actually working with monarchs and what are they actually doing like today in 2024 about monarchs? And so it is kind of like a fun snapshot into the day-to-day, like a day in the life of whoever is studying that particular insect.
Yeah, and it's nice to be able to see, you know, what kind of jobs are out there for people who are interested in insects. And so I hope that the show can like inspire some future entomologists.
I think showing community science is so important too. It's something I've been trying to do more in my science journalism, because getting involved in community science myself has made me realize that it is a way that you can feel so empowered to actually make a difference about, you know, something you care about, and also to make that community. And I feel like you make that community not just with other naturalists or people who are interested in science in your area, but also you make that community with the whatever you're studying. Like for me here, that's whales, but it could be ladybugs or monarch butterflies or that, or really anything. And so I think it is a way, I think, for people who maybe you dreamed of being a biologist when you were a kid and that didn't end up being what you ended up doing, but you can still get involved. So I think it's great to show that.
I think that's a really good point, because I don't know if you ever feel this way, but I feel like every one of us suffers the risk that we think we're not enough of something to be a member of that group. Like, I'm not an entomologist enough to actually be an entomologist. I'm not a scientist enough to be in, call myself a scientist. But actually, we probably all are scientists. So my Nana is 98 and she was a homemaker. She did not go to university. She did not do a science degree, but I still think of her as an entomologist because she spent so much time in her garden doing horticulture and like basically learning all the pests that came to her plants and how to get rid of them. She knows them all, right? I call her an entomologist. So I think maybe like a show like this could maybe broaden people's perspectives of their definition, right? So everyone's a scientist in some way. Everyone's an entomologist probably in some way, if you like insects, whether at the community level or whether it's, you know, in some federally funded grant.
Absolutely. You also serve as curator and division chair of invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History. Could you talk a bit about that work and what it entails?
As a curator, you usually are responsible or in charge of a certain collection. So for my workplace at the American Museum, we have 23 million insect specimens or invertebrate specimens, because we also have marine invertebrate specimens and arachnids. But 23 million, it's a lot. So curators, we kind of each are responsible for multiple collections. So I'm responsible for what they call the basal hexapods, like silverfish, firebrats, small winglets, sisters to the rest of the winged insects. And then I'm responsible for all of non-holometabola, which are the insects that don't have complete metamorphosis. So these are things like true bugs, praying mantises, cockroaches, ice crawlers, stoneflies, dragonflies, mayflies, grasshoppers, crickets, stick insects, you know, you name it. So it's a lot of collections. And I work with a museum specialist. Her name is Ruth Salas. And her specialty is actually Hemiptera. And we kind of work together. People borrow specimens. It's kind of like a library, only with like kind of very strict credentials to get that library card. Because they don't just loan things to anybody. But like if you write to us and tell us that you're interested in working on a particular group and you'd like to look at some specimens, we can arrange loans to other institutions. And we can also take images of, you know, morphological features that you need to see for your work. And then we also have, I do my own research. My research really mostly focuses on dragonflies and damselflies, termites and cockroaches, but I also work on insect decline. And I have graduate students that work on those insects, but then also Strepsiptera and the sister group to bees and stoneflies and ice crawlers. So we work on a variety of things. And I guess the red thread that ties us together is that we're interested in insect evolution kind of broadly. So being at a museum is a great place to study evolution because we have fossils, we have modern lineages, we have lots of specimens, we have great genomics facilities. So I do a lot of genomics. I use whole genomes or partial genomes to understand evolutionary history. And then we also have really fancy microscopes. So we can like look at their morphology and revise their classification and make phylogenies, which are, we also call them trees, which are kind of a way of understanding how things are related to each other in evolutionary time. So it's a pretty fun job. Come visit anytime.
It sounds amazing. I mean, and especially at that particular museum, like I can only imagine what the behind the scenes looks like. And it must be so exciting to be able to walk through all of these shelves full of insects and have these collections that I would imagine go back hundreds of years, potentially. I know like even our own small entomology museum at the U of A, we have specimens from like 1870 or like things like that, that are just so old. It's hard to believe that like they're even still, they haven't like disintegrated into dust.
Yeah, that's part of the, like, I guess the stressful part about the job as a curator is that you're part of what you're tasked to do is to make sure that they don't disintegrate into dust. And thank goodness for the museum specialists who are here, who really have a lot of training in museum science. To, you know, make sure that we're using the right kind of paper for the labels, the right kind of boxes, everything is sealed and there's humidity. And there is a conservation department here whose goal is to kind of do environmental monitoring, pest management, because we have to worry about pests coming to try and eat the insects. There's lots of things that have evolved over evolutionary history to eat dead things. And we've got a lot of dead things here. So we have to kind of make sure that they don't eat our dead things. And so it's really great to have people who are like dedicated to help us kind of ensure their safety. Most definitely. Yeah. we have an ancient DNA lab here. And it allows us to get DNA from very old specimens. So my postdoc, Lacey Newton, and I, we extracted and sequenced DNA from dragonflies that were from the mid-1800s. And it was wild because, I mean, it was before my grandparents were born. My dad, my paternal grandfather, was born in 1900. So it was before his parents were born, probably, like that, like my mind blown.
How do you do that? Because to my knowledge, and I don't know too much about genetics, unfortunately, but I've seen friends of mine have to collect butterflies that have to be kept alive until they're brought into the lab, and then they can be put in like an unbelievably cold freezer to preserve the genetics. So how are you doing that with something that old?
Yeah, it can be very hard because over time, DNA, what they call degrades, it breaks down into small little pieces. So sequencing it can be really challenging. And the risk is that like you'll have very little of your small fragments of degraded DNA, and you'll have so much more of like my hair, my sneeze, my skin cells, right? So often early studies, when people tried to do ancient DNA, they kept getting things contaminated with like something they ate for lunch or their hair or whatever. So what we do in the ancient DNA lab here is it actually is like incredibly sterile. Everything gets bathed in like UV light at the end of the day. It's bleached completely. To go in it, you actually have to like have your hair tied back. You wear like, it's like going into an operating room. You wear like a little bonnet. You have like one of those Tyvek suits that you zip up, little booties and everything. You have to have gloves on at all times. So we really try and minimize any modern DNA from going into that room. So you assume everything in there is going to just be very, very low amounts of DNA. So that these small little fragmented piece of ancient DNA, you'll still be able to collect. But it is challenging to do. And there are some people here who have done it with a variety of taxa, because there's some mammalogists that work here and herpetologists, and they have a lot of struggles because often those specimens are fixed with formalin, and it can make it really challenging to get DNA out of things that have been treated with a formaldehyde or formalin. For ours, the dragonflies in general from the 1800s, someone collected them, like wrapped them in a piece of newspaper or something, and they just sat this way the whole time, which actually isn't terrible for their DNA, you know? So in general, we got like not a ton of DNA, but we got some DNA, and we were able to sequence it and try and like figure out, you know, where it fits with the still living representatives of those species, which is kind of neat. And even just with like regular molecular lab, we got stuff from 1900, 1909, like not in the ancient DNA lab.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. And so you're trying to figure out how the genetics of these populations have changed over time. Is that sort of the goal?
Yeah, that was our goal of doing the ancient DNA sequencing. And then even just for the ones that we've sampled that are over 100 years old, we actually chose to sequence those because we wanted to know if there was DNA in our museum specimens. And if there was, that would be great, because we're trying to create a phylogeny that has a tree that has all of the species of dragonflies and damselflies. There's, you know, almost 6,500 or so species. And we want to sequence all of them. But some of the taxa are like rare or infrequently collected, or maybe they haven't been recently collected. So using museum specimens can be a great option. Plus, it's hard to travel everywhere to get these specimens fresh. So museum specimens are like a treasure trove of data if there's DNA in there. And it turns out that there's pretty good DNA in there.
I have a question, because I was watching your videos and you mentioned in one of them that early in your career, when you're trying to decide what you wanted to do, you were thinking, well, maybe entomology related to crop sciences or food security might be the right choice because it sort of feels like it's for the greater good. And then you sort of learn more about systematics and evolution and found that you could still do research that is for the greater good in whatever definition of that there is. And I've really struggled with that question too. And I find it really interesting to think about what that means, like finding meaning in research. And I guess I just was wondering if you could elaborate on how you found how something like understanding systematics and evolution helps us protect present and future biodiversity. I know that's kind of a big question, but I'd love to hear your thoughts further on that.
Yeah, I mean, it is like a debate maybe as old as time, right, in the entomology departments between people who are ostensibly kind of saving the world, doing, you know, mosquito abatement or, you know, food security, you know, versus people who are doing systematics for systematic sake, right? But I do think it's kind of like when I was going to graduate school, that seemed like there was conflict, but actually I would say like put those two things together, right? Because actually it's really hard to understand vector-borne illnesses, right? The vectors, unless you understand how it's almost always flies, although it's not only flies, but how the flies are related to each other. And the same is true for mosquito abatement. I mean, there's going to be slightly different things that you might do for Culex or for Aedes or for Anopheles mosquitoes, right? We actually do need to know something about species designations and relationships. Evolution is kind of the thing that ties everything together. So, I mean, I think that there's no reason for those to be diametrically opposed types of entomology, right? Those are things where there could be a lot of collaboration and maybe personal growth, I would argue, because talking to people who work on slightly different things can be really good to come up with new ideas. I think for me, you know, I thought that also systematic seemed like maybe it wasn't going to save the world. And that was a mistake, right? Because now I know that there are some questions related to conservation where we really need to know how many species we have, right? There's an example. One of my graduate students is defending his thesis tomorrow, Ethan Tolman, and he works on a group of dragonflies that are called the petal tails. And one of the genera, Petalura, it's found in Australia. It's considered to be rare. And in some cases, some of the species are listed as endangered, right? You're not allowed to collect them anymore. And we're fairly certain that they're going to go extinct sometime soon, right? So the question was whether or not one of these ones, which actually has like government protection, should be synonymized with this one that doesn't have government protection. And Ethan's work actually is going to determine the fate. If he synonymizes these two things and this one that has government protection loses government protection, right? If he was to synonymize it, then that might lead to the kind of acceleration of the loss of that particular population. It turns out his research doesn't suggest that they should be synonymized. Who do we look to? We look to the systematists, right? Who can actually tell us whether the species are different and whether or not you need actually to have two types of protections because they're different species and they might be in different site, occupying slightly different niche space. Knowing something about biodiversity is going to be really important as the climate changes, as things invade into new areas, you know, because people have found that a lot of insects are expanding their ranges. And when something comes into a new area, often the first thing people say is like, what is that? What's happening? Why is this happening? Who do you look to? A systematist, right? You look to a taxonomist who can tell you what the species is and where it normally is found and whether this is unusual or whether there should be alarm. So I think, you know, I've kind of recentered myself. And I think that systematics is actually, it's a very helpful field to be in, as well as being kind of fascinating, because it is the closest thing you're going to get to a time machine.
Yeah, it's so cool. Like, I mean, it is the building blocks of everything we study. Like, how do we define what we're looking at? We have to use the genetics, we have to use the taxonomy. And yeah, it is such a time machine. I mean, I've got a friend looking at butterfly genomics, and she is able to see how glaciation has separated populations over time, and just by looking at the genetics. And I think that is so cool and exciting. So yeah, I totally agree. And I think it's so fascinating.
Well, I guess like moving a bit even further back in your career, I'd love to hear a bit more about what drew you to studying insects. Before we started recording, you mentioned that you had originally come to UBC here in Vancouver to study marine biology. I think a lot of biologists probably start out that way. I know, like, I wanted to be a marine biologist when I was a kid. And yeah, what shifted your thinking about what you wanted to study?
Well, it's actually funny. I went to UBC because no one in my family were scientists. I didn't know any scientists at all. In my life, one of my parents' friends said, since I spent a lot of time up in Northern Ontario, you know, swimming in the lake, they said, if you like being in the water so much, you should be an oceanographer. So I just kind of like memorized that word. And then I looked up where there was oceanography, and it was Dalhousie and UBC. And I figured UBC would be farther away. So I figured I'd pick UBC. And then when I went there, so I signed up for oceanography classes and all that jazz. When I went there, then someone who ended up being, I think, maybe it was my chemistry TA, I forget, but he said, oceanography is the study of waves. if you want to study the animals, you need to actually study marine biology. And I was like, whoa, oh no. And then I had to go and change all my classes and like get a new schedule. And it was very stressful. But one of the classes that I ended up switching into was invertebrate zoology, and Karen Needham taught it. And I remember her saying, in the beginning, we learned about like sponges and cnidaria, and like, it was very cool. And I thought, this is what I want to do forever. I want to study freshwater sponges and like, what are spicules and like, what's happening with their internal anatomy. And then Karen Needham came to give the, I guess she taught the section on insects, and she walked up to the podium and she said something like, there's more insects than anything else on the entire planet. And I was like, whoa, that was it. And I was an entomologist because I was like, I want to study something, you know, that is like, there's room for discovery. You know, there's a bunch, she talked about how there was a bunch of stuff that was unknown, species that had yet to be described. And I really liked that idea. And then over time, I took an entomology class and learned more about insects. And I also learned that you could do a lot of things with insects that you couldn't do if you were studying whales, because only so many whales, and people would sign up, you know, for 1 week long to study this whale. And I thought, that's bananas, because I could just go out and study as many dragonflies as I want right now without having to sign up for it. And I like that idea too, is just having a bit more freedom with the research. And I was fortunate enough that I was on a student loan, and that allowed me to have a work study job. And so I was able to work in the entomology department, and I guess it was called zoology then, the zoology groups. I worked with Judy Myers on some integrated pest management biocontrol stuff. And I worked on with Diane Shavastava on some damselfly poop stuff. And I just, the more I learned about it, the more I wanted to learn.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear you talk about like wanting to study that breadth, because, you know, after hearing you describe your research, like you're really doing that, like you're it's like everything and the vast amount of the number of species. And it is really different. I mean, yeah, I get to meet a lot of marine biologists, and I think the ones that do work on whales feel like they won the lottery, because most of them don't actually get to do that. And yeah, I mean, from watching Olivia, it's like, it seems like, this is just an outsider perspective, but it seems so cool to be able to be excited by something that's like all around you and that most people don't notice.
Yeah.
We also wanted to ask you about, you know, the work that you've done to encourage and support people of color in entomology, especially as co-founder of Entomologists of Color. Could you talk more about that work and your goals with it?
Sure. Well, I think, you know, my personal experience was I've never had a Black teacher. And when I was at UBC, I was the only Black person that I remember seeing in the department. And it was the same when I was in graduate school. There were no other Black students or faculty. When I was a postdoc, same. And then when I got my first faculty job, I was the only Black person who was a faculty member in the sciences. So there weren't a lot of faculty that looked like me either. And so that was kind of like my frame of reference that I was coming to 2020 with. And when my lab and I, and former graduate students, and at the time present graduate students, and I, we were really just thinking about ways that we could try and kind of grapple with the fact that there's a lot of inequity in science. We weren't quite sure what we could do to move the needle, because who are we to try and move the needle when National Science Foundation and other institutes have tried to, quote unquote, diversify or broaden participation, I think is what they say, and hadn't necessarily succeeded. So we wanted to try and maybe look through the literature, and we looked through at who, you know, the survey of earned doctorates, and the numbers are really reflecting what we ourselves as a group of people who, a lot of whom are people of color, what we had experienced, right? That there's the numbers of women are low, but actually if you look at the number of white women and you look at the number of women of color, the number of women of color barely even make it off of the zero line on the graph. If you look at, you know, who's getting a Bachelor of Science versus a Master's versus a PhD versus a faculty job, the numbers just get even lower towards zero. And we wanted to try and change that. We thought that maybe recruitment, retention, and advocacy were three things that we could do simultaneously. Recruitment, we decided to do a fundraising campaign, and we give away free memberships to students of color worldwide so that way they could get their foot in the door, go to meetings at a reduced rate, have access to the journals. A lot of times society journals are behind a paywall unless you're a member, and kind of encourage people to go to entomolo- entomology meetings wherever they are. For the Entomological Society of America, which is the largest insect organization in the world, we have had mentoring events where people were paired with mentors, and that allowed them to kind of go and meet people and kind of get their foot in the door with some of the networking that we know can really help with retention. In terms of retention, we have had, you know, at times it's kind of ebbed and flowed, I guess, depending on enthusiasm and volunteer capacity. We've had like different types of journal clubs in different languages to try and keep our minds thinking about entomological content. We've had funding for activities where people could go and do field work. And we've really just, I guess, tried to encourage any type of capacity building that people are interested in. We've done, you know, workshops. We've practiced science communication and presentation skills, and talked a lot about the hidden curriculum of how to get into academia. If you aren't from a family where there were other academics, or if you didn't know people who are academics, some of it is just kind of assume that you know. But if you don't, if you didn't grow up with that, then you don't know. And that was my experience, not knowing any of those hidden kind of secrets. And so we're trying to make that more public, I guess, and more knowledgeable for everybody. And then for advocacy, I think one thing that we really wanted to do was not necessarily just force people to assimilate into a system that is toxic, but to actually try and change the system. So we've really challenged entomology departments kind of across North America is where we started and where we focused our efforts to highlight, to do their own research and figure out who were the first, you know, African-American, first Asian-American folks that got PhDs in the department, and highlight them and challenge them about their admissions practices and what are we valuing in terms of the awards that we receive. We've worked with our scientific societies to try and look at that. Often, a lot of the wealth, access to specimens, access to genomics facilities, fancy scanning electron microscopes, and what have you, a lot of that is really concentrated in the global north. And what that means is that if you don't have access to funding to do whole genomes, which per PacBio whole genome is about $1,500 per one, if you don't have access to those funds, then you're not going to do that type of research, right? You're going to do research that doesn't cost as much money. And sometimes when people are faced on an admissions committee or on a grant panel or an awards panel with two people who have applied, one of whom who have done a bunch of whole genomes and one of who maybe has done ethology, like behavioral observations or, you know, Sanger-based CO1 data, what have you, they often will favor the person that's done whole genomes. And so then the rich get richer, right? You know, just accumulating this academic success. So we really tried to speak publicly at conferences and through communications with people in different universities about ways that we could reassess, you know, the rubric that we're using, the measure of success, so that it doesn't continue to be perpetually biased against, you know, marginalized groups. But hopefully, and we've done like, we've written some stuff about it in the literature and have a few more things in the works. So I think our goal with advocacy is not necessarily to burn everything to the ground, but, you know, to kind of challenge ourselves to be better and challenge ourselves to think about the type of science that we want to have and what our shared values are. And I think that is something that works well with then, you know, changing the system enough that you would retain people and hopefully also recruit more people.
Yeah. It's interesting because I saw your panel at the Vancouver ESC joint annual meeting, that conference, which had a long name that I always forget how to say, but that was an amazing panel. And I remember that helped. I think a lot of the people in my lab talk about these issues more. And something I remember seeing at that particular conference, because it was the Entomological Society of America and of Canada, is they had, I guess they were like mixers specifically for Black entomology students and Latinx students as well. And that was something I'd never seen with the Entomological Society of Canada, because honestly, there are not enough students or just entomologists of color in general in the society to have those kinds of events. And I was like, wow, that's not good. Like, we have a really long way to go. But this advocacy work is amazing, and definitely encourage our listeners to check it out. And you've written or co-wrote an article on for people of color in the field on dealing with all of this and strategies for that, that I thought was really cool. So we'll have to link that in the show notes as well for anyone who's interested.
Yeah, that would be great because I think anyone who wants to get involved, you're always welcome. We also do like a visibility campaign. So if people are like really savvy about social media posts, or if they want to, you know, if you speak another language and you want to lead a journal club session in Finnish or Swahili, like, please let us know. And I think that there's a lot of chances for people to kind of make a difference because we've already seen that the students that go through this ENTO POC program are called INSTARS. And several of the INSTARS, because now it's been 4 years, have, you know, graduated and gone on to graduate school themselves. And it's really exciting to see the impact that, you know, enthusiasm in this topic. Like, we, if we care about it and we want to diversify entomology, we can do it. We can do it. So people just need to join in.
Yeah, having that mentorship is so important. I mean, I wouldn't be in entomology if it weren't for my mentors, for sure. So I can only imagine, like, it's so important and so positive. And yeah, it's great, especially for academia, which, yeah, like, how to get into this field is like hidden secret info. No one's giving you courses on it in undergrad, which I think is ridiculous. But
yeah, if I hadn't, like I said, if Karen Needham hadn't walked into that classroom and talked about insects, I don't know that I would necessarily have gone in. I always thought insects were interesting, and I definitely was not afraid of them. I thought they were very, very cool, but I certainly wouldn't have known that this was a job, right? I came from a working class family, and I really just don't know anyone that knew that this was a job. Because even when I said I want to be an entomologist, my family and family friends were like, "What are you talking about? Like, what is that job?" And it sounds like etymologist, like the language, like the origin of words. And that tripped people up, like, what? I thought you were doing science.
Oh, I did actually have one question. It's kind of like a more fun question, but like, is there a scientific concept or question that, you know, if like a genie appeared and said, I will tell you the answer to like one scientific question, what would it be? Like, what's something that you really want to know about entomology?
Oh, there's two. Can I have two? I have two.
Yeah.
So the first one is, I would ask, is it true that the endosymbionts in the hindgut of termites are what drove their social behavior? So is it true that, like, somehow needing to be able to digest wood is what led to overlapping generations so that they could, you know, imbibe anal secretions from each other? That would be like, I guess I wouldn't want it to be a true false. I wouldn't want it to be true false. I want it to be open-ended questions so that they have to explain to me the origin of my sociality. And yeah. Then I would ask where the origin of odonates, of dragonflies and damselflies were. Because if dragonflies and damselflies are like 250 million years old or so, and so maybe, like, you know, there's like some supercontinent, what happened? Was it that there was an ancestor that they share with mayflies that gave rise to odonates? Or was it that there was nothing, and then there was like a proto dragonfly, and then dragonflies, and then everything else came afterwards, which is like this hypothesis people call the Paleoptera problem. Like, is it dragonflies sister to the rest of the winged insects, or is it dragonflies and mayflies sharing an ancestor sister to the rest of the winged insects? Or is it that mayflies came first? Bleh, probably not. Boo, hiss. And then dragonflies. So, like, this is like so hot. This is like a real hot topic. And I've always, maybe it was dragonflies first, or maybe mayflies and dragonflies sharing a common ancestor. But I would hope the genie would tell me that one, because that would be cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That like missing link, try and find the perfect like ephemera, yeah, like mayfly, odonate.
I would love
combo.
It.
That would be so fun. Or like a beautiful fossil.
Yeah.
That just told us everything. Because
then, I mean, then you'd know like the origin of flight, man. Like, you'd know, like, before birds, like before anything else, it was insects that flew. So if you knew the answer to that, you'd know like the first thing in the skies. That would be cool.
That would be so cool. Yeah. I think it's amazing that, like, okay, I think like dragonflies are like the coolest things that fly still. And it's wild that they like did it first. And like, yeah, for the most part, I guess, or like possibly the mayflies. But I also don't, like, I get that this is going to get super nerdy. So maybe this is like not accessible to non-entomologists, but I don't get how, like, I understand that direct flight muscles take a lot of energy to utilize, but I don't understand why there's not more groups of insects that have direct flight muscles, because it seems to be so good at the flying part, the control that they
I mean,
have.
This is it. So like to what you're referring, that's one of the reasons why we think maybe dragonflies were the first, because they have this type of flight muscle that's different from all the other insects. That's a plus for dragonflies being first. They also have two penises, and they have the sperm from their primary penis gets ejaculated into their secondary penis at the base of their abdomen. And that's how sperm is transferred. But maybe that's just like a throwback to having a spermatophore or a sperm packet, which is what the non-winged insects, the basal hexapods, do. That's another point for dragonflies first, right? But mayflies do have, they do have a final molting when they're an adult, from subimago to imago to adult. And that's a point for mayflies. And I heard that there's a person here, Hollister Herhold, who did a bunch of internal anatomy of insects using computed tomography, like basically x-rays of their body to look at their tracheal system. And it turns out that mayflies have something different from everything else. So then I was like, okay, so that's a point for mayflies being first, maybe.
Yeah.
But maybe they just share a common ancestor. And so and Paleoptera, which is the group that is mayflies and dragonflies together, maybe they're just sister to everything. But see, we need the genie to know, because no matter how much money we've thrown at this problem with genomes and genetics, we still haven't solved it. So the genie's the only solution.
Do you think that one day we'll know? Or is it one of those things where it's we'd have to find an enormous amount of fossil evidence or something? Or do you think that genomics could potentially give us that answer at some point?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it's the only other option we have left, right? Because we've subsampled the genome, where we have thousands of loci and we haven't answered it, but maybe doing the entire genome. Now there's a dozen or so odonate genomes that are either published or in the works, being analyzed right now. And so, maybe we'll have enough information that maybe we could answer that question. But if the genomes don't tell us what we were looking for, then I don't know what to do. Because that's the last frontier. That's the only other thing we had left, right? Because we've looked at their external anatomy. Hollister and others have started looking at the internal anatomy, and we still keep getting kind of mixed ideas. So
we need the genie.
Yeah. The mysteries evade us.
I will just say one thing about Animal Crossing. My lab, I have graduate students and postdocs, and everyone's pretty jazzed about Animal Crossing. And one of my graduate students, or maybe a couple of them actually, they dressed up as characters from Animal Crossing 2 Halloweens in a row. So, because there's an entomologist, the entomologist with the net.
Yeah.
Yeah, the little chameleon.
And there's an
guy.
Owl, right?
That's Blathers, yeah.
That's Blathers. So I think them was also Blathers. So I feel like they're going to be really jazzed that I just mentioned them, actually. But yeah, I just think it's great that there's a gateway. I do think that maybe people would play this and then maybe get curious. And then the whole world is Animal Crossing, actually, in some ways, right? So this is a good gateway to get people to think that insects and collecting are cool.
Yeah, lots of my friends are it's the Pokemon Go, Pokemon to entomology pipeline. It's a thing. The whole obsession with collecting.
It is a pretty fun gig, I would say. And you get to be outside all the time, which is really nice.
Well, thank you so much. Yeah, it was so great to chat with you. And definitely our listeners should check out Insectarium. I think, if you enjoyed Olivia's entomology episodes, you will love to dive even deeper and get to actually see things. It's cool. It's cool to see. Yeah.
Yeah, get some visuals.
Definitely check it out. And thank you so much, Dr. Ware, for joining us.
Yeah, thank you. It was great chatting with you.
Thanks for having me. That was super too. And yeah, come visit the museum anytime. We have lots of specimens just waiting to be seen. So come by anytime.
Oh, definitely on my list. If you want to support the show, you can join our Patreon to get exclusive rewards, and you can check out our Etsy shop to see the stickers and postcards we have for sale.
And you can always follow us on Instagram and TikTok.
Tune in next time to learn more about the insects, fish, and fossils you can find in Animal Crossing: New Horizons. Bye!
Bye!